to this week's quantum gravity seminar, which is not really about quantum gravity, but it's certainly a very challenging point of view on our perspective of what we think of, or think of ourselves as physicists, what we can say about the world. And we're very happy to have Stuart Kaufman here
to tell us
about the end of a physics worldview.
It is the end of a physics worldview. Thank you for being here. I think the attitude you should have towards this is, I'm a biologist. I do a bit of physics and a bit of economics. And I'm going to tell you something that I hope you will enjoy. And it's liberating. It's not frightening. So just enjoy. So the title of the talk that I have is the end of a physics worldview at the watershed of life. And what I'm going to tell you, and it takes some while to actually hear it, is we can't do Newton at all for evolving life. There's no laws like Newton's laws or Schrodinger's equations for the becoming of the biosphere. I think you'll agree that it's true. And then the question is, well, now what? And the answer is lots, so let's explore it. But first, I just want you to think that right in this room and out the window is the most complex system we know in the universe, the biosphere. Life originated about 3.7 billion years ago, and it's made redwood trees and sea urchins and ferns and us. And the other thing I'm going to start with is something that sounds like a very naive question. I trained as an MD. Everybody in this room has a heart. And if you don't, please leave, because you're dead. And the question I want to start with is why, here's the Big Bang, 13.8 billion years ago, I gather now. Why are there hearts in the universe? It's going to become more and more mysterious as we ask why are there hearts in the universe. So, I guess I'd do this. So I'm going to take you through a bunch of stuff you know. So I'm going to stand here and read it, because I can read it. Is that all right? You can read it up there. You know all of this. So Newton, the Newtonian paradigm, which, I mean, one human being invented it. It's just astonishing. And Newton gives us laws of motion in differential equation form, initial and boundary conditions. And then we're supposed to take his differential equations and integrate them to get the trajectories of the balls on a pre-stated phase space. A crux thing is you physicists always have a pre-stated phase space. So to be very simple and concrete, it's the billiard balls on the table, and if the billiard balls stay on the table, you know all possible positions and momenta of the balls on the table, and that's the phase space. And that's a canonical example. So Newton's laws of motion, given, there's a few mistakes, given for the balls, and the initial and position and momenta, and the boundary conditions, that's the phase space, and the space space is the space of all possible states. As you all know, integration of the ordinary differential equations yields the trajectories of the balls in the pre-stated phase space, and partial differential equations are fundamentally the same thing. I want to ask what it is to integrate Newton's equations. It's to deduce the consequences of Newton's differential equation for the motions of the balls. So integration is entailment. It's the same as, excuse me, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. So Newton's laws in differential form entail the trajectories of the balls, and it's the determinism of classical physics. So as you all know, classical physics determinism, classical mechanics, Maxwell's occasional equation, special and general relativity. The only exception in classical physics is statistical mechanics, and the exception is due to the ergodic hypothesis, where fundamentally you give up integrating Newton's equations and you make the statement the system spends equal time and equal volumes of phase space, and you get statistical mechanics, but it's no longer causal, but it works. And if you have an open box with particles flowing into and out, it's the same thing. And you all know this, but in classical physics, for example, the throws of the dice of probability, it's merely epistemic. In a pre-stated phase space or sample space, we have the probability measure. And since we have a probability measure, we can define random because we know the sample space of the process. For example, you assume fair dice. I can tell you that all of this fails in the evolving biosphere. So quantum mechanics. This is a first crisis in physics, and you all know it. So Planck, quantum mechanics, the quantum of actions, the advent of quantum, excuse me, ontological indeterminism, quantum jumps between energy levels of sodium, It's not deterministic in the Copenhagen interpretation, but of course it is on Bohm, but Bohm is incredibly non-local. Vast debate. Einstein refuses and says God doesn't play dice. This is a huge recovery. I mean, a huge crisis in physics, and you all know it. But you recovered the Newtonian paradigm, because Schrodinger's equation is a linear partial differential wave equation. So quantum mechanics is still entirely within the Newtonian paradigm. So there's a pre-stated phase space and a deterministic trajectory in that phase space. But the deterministic trajectory, as you all know, is a probability distribution. And then there's the magic of whatever measurement is, and collapse of the wave function, or whatever you want to say. And it's the same thing for quantum field theory, which I only understand a tiny bit, and everybody in the room does. Then we get to the standard model of particle physics. Let's go back to Newton. So 100 years after Newton, and you all know this, Laplace comes along and says, you know, if you knew the positions and momenta of all the particles in the universe, Laplace's demon in the sky, who's of course French, can figure out all the future and past trajectories of all the particles. And that is the modern birth of reductionism. It's the dream that down there, which I think most of you either believe or hope for, there's a theory that entails everything that becomes in the universe. And that's Weinberg with Dreams of the Final Theory. And it's a magnificent dream. I'm going to tell you that it doesn't work for the biaser at all. And that's the main point about where I'm getting to. And that's going to be another crisis or opportunity in physics. So that's really what I'm talking about today. So there's been doubts about reductionism. In 1977, Phil Anderson wrote a paper in Science, More is Different. And Anderson's point was there can be laws at a higher level that cannot be reduced to the lower level. And Nobel laureate Robert Langdon says the same thing in the universe from the bottom down. So this raises the issue of emergence. And the argument here is there are laws at the higher level. For example, you can use cellular automata to get the Navier-Stokes equation, and then you can't reduce it to the lower level. Therefore, is emergence real? But for Laughlin and for Anderson, there are still laws that you can hope to reduce or not reduce to the lower level, and that's a huge issue. Where we're going to go is that for the evolution of the biosphere, there's no laws at all. So if I'm right, this is quite a crisis in physics, because you can't do it. Okay. So this is what I want to say. This may be a new, larger crisis for physics or the physics worldview, or it's not a crisis, it's an opportunity. There's no entailing laws at all for evolving biasers anywhere in the universe. So what do I mean by anywhere in the universe? Well, we know that there's on the order of 10 to the 22 stars in the universe. It's estimated that some fair fraction of them have solar systems. So there's on the order of 10 to the 22 solar systems. If molecular reproduction happens easily, I think it does, and I can try to tell you why, there's biospheres all over the universe. There's a lot of life out there, like this one. Okay, so I've now said this. So I've now said it and I've announced it. No entailing laws at all for the evolution of this or any biosphere. And I've said all of this. So I have to tell you something that's obvious, except you may not have thought about it. So you all know what a protein is. There's 20 kinds of amino acids, and a protein typically has on the order of 200 or 300 amino acids, and a typical protein in you has 300 amino acids long. How many possible proteins are there with 200 amino acids? Well, it's 20 times 20 times 20, 200 times. 20 to the 200th is 10 to the 260th. Let's ask if the universe can have created all of them in the lifetime of the universe. So as you all know, the fastest time scale in the universe is the Planck time scale. There's 10 to the 80th particles. So if they were doing nothing, ignoring space-like separation, but being busy making proteins length 200, how long do you think it would take to make all possible proteins length 200? Anybody got an idea? It's the current age of the universe raised to 10 to the 35th power. And this means something physical. The universe at the level of complex things like proteins will only make an incredibly tiny fraction of them. The universe is grotesquely non-ergodic, non-repeating at levels of complexity above quite simple things. This means something important about your heart. Most complex things will never come to exist. So how come you have a heart? Can you hear it? So I'll tell you a bit more about this. There's now decent analysis that says, so let's just look at this. You all know this, but you have the Big Bang and nucleosynthesis, and you get 100 stable atoms. Then you get the formation of simple, then ever more complex molecules. So I've already said it. Most complex things will never exist. So I now want to say and introduce a word. The universe evolves into its ever new, what I will call adjacent possible, at the levels of molecules and living things. The adjacent possible is what can come to be given what's around now. So in the economy, once there's rockets, the space station can come to exist. Once there's bows, the crossbow can come to exist. Once there's frogs, something can evolve out of frogs. And in the evolution of the universe, let me just tell you a bit about that. We all know that roughly 500 million to a billion years after the Big Bang, you have nucleosynthesis and very few complex molecules. By the time you get to 5 billion years ago on the Murchison meteorite, there's on the order of 55 or 60,000 complex molecules on that meteorite and in the moon of Enceladus. And on Earth now, there's about 100 million molecules. So the universe has increased in the diversity of its molecules. It's making molecules that never existed before. It's still doing so, and it has been for billions of years. It's entering into an adjacent possible. And please capture the notion, the universe cannot exhaust the indefinite, what I will call sink, upward in complexity. We can make space stations, we can make trade towers, we can make elephants, we can make Tyrannosaurus Rex. Upward in diversity and complexity, essentially there is no real limit. Okay, so. Oops. So, I want to ask how complex things can come to exist in the universe. Well, one way is to be a planet. There's a lot of planets. They're a lot more complicated than stars, as you all know. Or you can be an asteroid, or a big rock, or a giant cold to dark cloud in a galaxy. But one way to get to exist in the non-ergodic universe above the level of atoms, and by the way, there's now good evidence that the universe is essentially ergodic, up to about 500 Daltons. The universe has made all possible molecules up to about 500 Daltons. It's non-ergodic above 500 Daltons, for example, for proteins and for people. So one way to get to exist, and let me really get this across, is to be what I will call a Kantian hole. So as you can guess, Kantian holes are named for Kant, who said this in about 1790. So hear it. It's not physics. Hear it. He says, an organized being, then, has the property that the parts exist for and by means of the whole. So you're a Kantian whole. Your heart exists for and by means of the rest of you. You're a Kantian whole, and the heart is sustaining your life. So you're a Kantian whole. All organisms are Kantian wholes. And I'm now going to give you a very simple example of a Kantian whole. So I've got it right here. The whole exists for and by means of its parts. So I wanted to find a collectively autocatalytic set. So it's an old idea I've had about the origin of life. It's turning out it's probably right. So here's the idea. I'll pick Andrew and Lee and me. So I catalyze or speed up the reaction that forms Lee by gluing together two Lee parts. Lee catalyzes the formation of Andrew by gluing together two Andrew parts, and Andrew speeds up the formation of Stu by gluing together two Stu parts. That's a collectively autocatalytic set. No molecule catalyzes its own formation. Collectively, we do. We achieve a kind of collective holism as this set, and we make ourselves. It's not mythical. Gonen Ashkenazi in the Ben-Gurion has 9 peptides. Peptides are short amino acids. And each peptide catalyzes the formation of the next peptide around a cycle of 9 by gluing together two parts of the next peptide and around the cycle. And it's a non-equilibrium system. You feed it with matter and energy, and it keeps reproducing, and it does. Already this means something essential. You all know that people very much like the idea of DNA and RNA for the origin of molecular reproduction. Gonin has a set made out of proteins. You do not need DNA and you do not need RNA to get molecular reproduction. You need autocatalysis. And DNA copying itself is also autocatalysis. I'll just tell you right now, there's a recent paper that's not quite out yet by Joanna Xavier and Bill Martin. I'm an author, but I did nothing on it. They took an archaea from more than 2 billion years ago and a bacterium from more than 2 billion years ago, and they analyzed the small molecule metabolism in that organism, including iron-sulfur complexes, with no polymers. There's no proteins, there's no RNA, there's no DNA. The metabolism itself is collectively autocatalytic. You can have a collectively autocatalytic metabolism, and I think that in the origin of life, it started almost certainly with collectively autocatalytic metabolic systems of small molecules. I think we can make them, and I hope that we do so soon. So let's come back to Gonin's set. You can define something you cannot define in physics. What is the function? What's the function of your heart? The function of your heart is to pump blood. But your heart also makes heart sounds, and it jiggles water in your pericardial sac. Those are not the functions of your heart. And the reason is the function of your heart is that causal consequence that sustains the whole. So once you've said that you've got this self-reproducing system, a Kantian whole, you can define the function of the part as its causal role in sustaining the whole, but notice that typically that is a subset of its causal consequences. You can't do that in physics. You can't distinguish the function of a part from all of its other causal consequences. You guys talk about all the causal consequences when you were not doing quantum mechanics. Once you've got a whole that sustains itself, you can define the function of the part. Okay, so let me go on. So now please catch this. Here's Gonin, and he's got this 9-peptide autocatalytic set, and it's reproducing. It exists in the universe as a complex thing above the level of 500 Daltons in the non-ergodic universe. And so does Tyrannosaurus Rex for a while, and so do we, where the name of the game is getting to exist for quite a while, okay? So I'm going to go on, but I want you to begin to catch. I mean, Gonin built his system. Your heart evolved. The reason there are hearts in the universe is they sustain the existence of the things that contain them. It is by virtue of the function of your heart in pumping blood and keeping you alive as an organism and the propagating biaser that hearts exist literally in the universe above the level of 500 Daltons. So it's not philosophy. We're talking about why hearts exist in the universe, or thumbnails, or apparatuses that we build. So this is causally important. In the non-ergodic universe, we all exist. So it matters physically to what happens in the universe. Okay, so I've already done this. Define the function of a part as its causal role in sustaining the whole. It's a subset of the causal consequences. Again, the function of the heart is to pump blood, not jiggle water in the pericardial sac. So again, vertebrates have hearts, but most complex things will not even exist. So why do hearts exist in the universe? Vertebrate organisms, for example, a human is a Kantian whole. You exist for and by means of your heart, you're a Kantian whole. Again, Darwin's account of the evolution of the heart is, it was a selective advantage for your ancestors to have a heart that pumps blood. What Darwin didn't realize he was explaining is he's actually explaining why hearts exist at all in the non-ergodic universe above the level of atoms. And the answer is life emerged 3.7 billion years ago with protocells, then single-cell organisms, then multi-cell organisms, then organisms with hearts, and here we are. That's why the heart exists. And it accounts for why things exist in the universe. So these are all comings into existence of hearts, flagellar motors, feathers, hearing, sight. They're all part of the becoming of the universe. They really are. We are part of the becoming of the universe. Our biaser and maybe 10 to the 22 biasers are part of the becoming of the universe. Now, Now I want to try to tell you that the phase space of biological evolution must include the functions of the parts in sustaining their wholes, the whole. Okay, so for example, why does heart exist? It exists because it's pumping blood and it sustains you. Therefore, we cannot talk about the phase space of biological evolution without including the functions of parts. It makes no sense. So in Gonen's Ashkenazi's little peptide set, the function of one of the peptides is to sustain the whole. That's why that peptide exists in the world. That's not where Gonen made it, leaving that out. Okay? Got it? So we're explaining why things exist in the universe, in the non-ergodic universe. So in our the notion of the phase space of the evolution of the biosphere, the functions of things are part of the phase space. Otherwise, they wouldn't exist in the universe. Hearts, again, only exist because you're a Kantian whole. And hearts exist because vertebrates arose, and they had hearts, and now there's hearts in the universe. The vertebrates have been around since the Ordovician, you know, 500 million years ago. That's why there are hearts in the universe. So we cannot talk about the evolution of the biosphere and its phase space. Yeah?
Sorry to interrupt.
What?
I didn't quite understand the difference between this and Darwin, in the sense that indeed Darwin didn't talk about function in phase space, but the function of a heart also part, the most important part of the in the fitness function, which gets chosen and hence in this way, it emerges.
Sure.
So yeah, so then I didn't quite get the example.
So what Darwin said was, so why do you have a heart? And he said, because in your ancestors, it was of selective advantage to have hearts that pump blood, and therefore organisms with hearts that pump blood left more offspring, and so there are hearts. But he's also explaining, although he didn't know it, why are there hearts in the non-ergodic universe above the level of 500 Daltons? Certainly Darwin never said that, but it's true. Is that making sense? Why are there hearts? It's because you have one, and hearts have been around for 500 million years, and vertebrates have evolved.
Probably initially it's not something like heart, but then through the evolution, the function gets selected. And
yeah, you're right, and we'll get to that in a minute. So life didn't start with hearts. It probably started with autocatalytic systems, and it evolved all kinds of things, and we'll get to that in a moment, because part of the mystery is we can't say ahead of time what's going to evolve. It's not that we can't predict it, we can't say it. So we'll get to that in a moment. So I want to distinguish, so I've just said now, the phase space of biological evolution includes functions, the function of the part. That's why there are hearts. I've said it several times, but it's a strange thought. Just let yourself absorb it. There are hearts in the universe because it helped Kantian wholes when they came into existence propagate, and hearts evolved, and now you're full of hearts. I want to distinguish diachronic versus synchronic science. Synchronic is what's happening right now. Do I think that reductionism will work to help explain how my heart functions now that it's come into existence? Sure. What you're not going to be able to do from physics alone is to explain why hearts came into existence in the last 3.7 billion years. And so this is going to be a world based on physics, but beyond it. So now I want to say that we cannot pre-state functions of things. So this is pretty striking. You all know the phrase in English, jury rigging. Does everybody know the phrase to jury rig something? Yes or no? Yeah, you know the word. So here's what jury rigging is. Something's not working in your house, and you go to the garage, and there's a bunch of junk in the garage, and there's a leak in the roof, and you say, how can I fix the leak in the roof? And there's a pot, and there's a hose, and there's a funnel, and you glue the funnel to the roof, and the water runs down through the hose, and it fills the pot. That's jerry-rigging, okay? You're using things to accomplish a task. And we do it all the time, right? I'm going to tell you that evolution does jerry-rigging all the time. Then I'm going to tell you we cannot restate the jury-rigging that life does or that we do. So I'll get to that in a moment. But So jury-rigging is to accomplish some task, you, us, using things but not for what they were designed. It's using unused causal consequences of things to accomplish some task. So let me make it concrete. The following story is said to be true. So about 60 years ago, or 70 years ago, some people were trying to invent the tractor. And so they said, boy, we're going to need a really big engine block. And they got a really big engine block, and they put it on a chassis. And it broke the chassis. So they put it on a bigger chassis, and it broke the bigger chassis. And they put it on a bigger chassis, and it broke the bigger chassis. Finally, and this is obviously in Texas, one of the guys says, you know, the engine block is so big and rigid, we can hang everything off the engine block and make it the chassis. That's jerry-rigging, okay? It is using an unused causal consequence of a part to accomplish a task. In this case, it's using the rigidity of the engine block to constitute a chassis. So that's an example, okay? Okay, that's jerry-rigging. So I'm gonna ask you a funny question. Here we are in Waterloo, I guess, Canada. Does everybody know what a screwdriver is? Okay, here's a screwdriver. Please, I'm serious about it. Please tell me all the things you can do with the screwdriver right here in Waterloo today. Tell me everything you can do with the screwdriver. Do you feel your mind going a little blank? What do you mean everything? But let's just take some uses of screwdrivers. So, you know, we've all used screwdrivers. What are some uses of screwdrivers? Come on, it's not that hard. You can screw in the screw, right?
Carve a pumpkin.
What? You can carve a pumpkin, right. Can you scrape putty off the window? Yes. Can you wedge a door closed? Yes. Can you wedge a door open? Yes. Can you scratch your back? Yes. My favorites include, can you tie it to a stick and spear a fish? Sure. Can you rent the spear out to the locals and take 5% of the catch? Sure. My other favorite is you lean it against the wall, you put a piece of plywood over it, and you put a wet oil painting underneath the thing to keep the rain off the wet oil painting. That's a perfectly fine use of a screwdriver.
Huh? You lean it against the wall, you bring it to an arm counter, and you sell it as a wonderful.
Yes, right. Yeah, right. You could also use it as a radio antenna, I guess. So, question. Serious question. Do you think the number of uses of a screwdriver today here in Ontario is some specific number, like 16 or 94? Do you think it's infinite, or do you think it's indefinite? What do you think? Seriously, what do you think? Yeah?
I think it's finite because we only have the Hubble time to specify.
Yes, that's true. So it's finite. I think it's finite. And I think it's indefinite. And so just imagine, y'all know James Bond. There's James Bond, and he's about to be murdered. And thank goodness there's a screwdriver around. And we know two things. There's a screwdriver, and the bad guy's going to wind up dead in a bottle of boiling oil, right? But we don't know exactly how James is going to do it. And will you buy indefinite? That there's no definite number. It's like, how many meanings does a metaphor have? We use things for all kinds of crazy purposes. And so my claim is that it's indefinite. I hope you'll allow it. Now, I want to remind you of four kinds of scales in mathematics. A nominal scale is just the name of things. Ordering relationship is x is greater than y and y is greater than z, so x is greater than z. An interval scale is an interval scale, but zero doesn't mean anything. And a ratio scale is 2 meters is twice 1 meter. What kind of relationship is there between the uses of a screwdriver? It's just a nominal scale. So there is no ordering relationship among claim, central. There is no rule following procedure. There's no algorithm that can list all the uses of a screwdriver or deduce the next use of a screwdriver. Finding new uses of screwdrivers is not algorithmic, but we do it all the time. So hang on to that, okay? So, so what we're up against is we find new uses of screwdrivers all the time, and think of James Bond, but these new uses of screwdrivers, it's not that they're unpredictable. It's not unpredictable like deterministic chaos, where you have a positive Lyapunov exponent. It's unprestatable. You can't say it. I mean, nobody knew that the guy was going to invent using the engine block to make the tractor as a chassis. It was an invention. And we do it all the time. And I'm about to show you that life does it all the time, too. They're called Darwinian pre-adaptations. So let me sort of jump to that, then I'll come back to it. All that has to happen in the evolution of some bacterium in a strange environment, hear my words, I'm choosing it carefully, that a molecular screwdriver in the bacterium, hear the phrase, find a use, a new use, that enhances the fitness of the bacterium, and if there's heritable variation and natural selection, that new use will come to exist in the biosphere. But we couldn't have said it ahead of time. I'm going to show you that it happens all the time. It's not we can't predict it, we can't say it. And if you think that this is silly, go back four centuries and try to think about the following. What's the price for a bicycle when you put it on eBay? Well, you couldn't even say it. You had to go back 4,000 years, or go back to the agricultural revolution, and you're going to talk about the price of a bike on eBay? No, you have no concept of eBay. So we'll continue. So evolution finds the uses of screwdrivers all the time, and these are called Darwinian pre-adaptations or exaptations. And I'm going to show you that a Darwinian pre-adaptation is not pre-statable. So some fish have an organ called a swim bladder. It's a sac partially filled with air and partially filled with water. The ratio of the two tunes neutral buoyancy in the water column. It works. They evolved from fish with lungs. And water got into some lungs, and it was kind of poised to evolve into a swim bladder. So Darwin's idea, to say it more firmly, Darwin said, you know, all sorts of things in you are selected to do things, like your heart pump blood, but in some funny environment, an unused causal consequence of some part of you could become selectively advantageous and come to exist. So my heroic example at age 80 is I'm in LA, and the heart is a resonant chamber, and I have a dominant mutation. I can pick up earthquake tremors. And I feel an earthquake coming on, and everybody dies. I become famous. I mate with many women. And pretty soon, there's lots of earthquake detectors in the biosphere. Who knew? So that's another example. Of course, that's fanciful. The swim bladder isn't. So if you think you can, I've now told you what a pre-adaptation is. Do you think right now you can say all the pre-adaptations that are going to happen in the biosphere in the next 5 million years? You can't even get started. What feature of what organism and what environment is useful to solve what task? You can't even get started. Try it. You can't. Okay? So, to continue. It's unprestatable. That means the following. Neutral buoyancy, to come back to this, it was a new function in the biosphere, right? It was neutral buoyancy in the water column. But you couldn't have said it beforehand. It is not possible to destate the emergence of this new function, or sight, or flight. Feathers evolved for thermoregulation and were co-opted as Darwinian pre-adaptations for flight. It's unprestatable. So the specific evolution of the biosphere is not prestatable. Now, the next part of this I find truly stunning. Evolution of the biosphere creates its own future possibilities of becoming without selection achieving it. I mean, Darwin said selection is really important, and he's right, but watch. Once a swim bladder exists, could a worm or a bacterial species evolve to live only in swim bladders? Sure, right? Agree? It's not physics, yes or no. Could a worm or bacterium evolve to live in a swim bladder? Yeah, of course, right? So let's think of the swim bladder as an empty, adjacent, possible niche into which a worm or a bacterium might come to live. Fair enough? So now we've got a funny question. Oh, note, by the way, that the swim bladder does not cause, but it enables the worm or bacterium to come and live in it. Some quantum random mutation, which is indeterminate, and you got some bacterium that can live in swim bladders, and it comes to live in swim bladders, nothing caused it. The fact that there was a swim bladder to live in enabled it. So it's not causal. Now, I think we would say something like the following. Just ask yourself the following question. Did natural selection, in some sense, act to craft a functioning swim bladder? Well, natural selection didn't act at all, but natural selection acted to make a functioning symbiotic, namely, it was under natural selection. I think we're all happy with that. Now I'm going to ask you a funny question. Did selection act to create the symbiotic such that the symbiotic once created would constitute an empty adjacent possible niche into which the bacterium or the worm might come and live? No. No. Selection didn't create the symbiotic such that a bacterium or a worm could come to live in it. That means something profound. It means that the biosphere, without selection doing it, is creating its own future pathways of becoming. The biosphere is creating its own ways in which it will become. Isn't that astonishing? There's no cause at all. It just happens. So is the economy, by the way. We'll get to that in a moment briefly. So, therefore, we cannot prestate. This means the following things. We cannot prestate the relevant variations or functionalities in the evolution of the biosphere. For example, neutral buoyancy, flagellar motors, feathers evolved for thermoregulation then to flight. And we cannot prestate the new empty adjacent possible niches into which the biosphere becomes. That means we cannot prestate what is in the adjacent possible of the evolution of the biosphere. So let's just stop. This is really weird. But so think of your canonical phase space with the six n degrees of freedom. You can prestate all the possibilities. Newton told us how to do it. Can you say now all the possibilities that will come up in the evolution of the biosphere? No. You can't even say them, let alone predict them. So the adjacent possible, what can come to be next, given that there's vertebrates, what can come to be next, given that there's bacteria, what can come to be next, you can't even say what is in the adjacent possible in the evolution of the biosphere. And this is going to have alarming consequences. So that means the following thing. If we don't know what is in the adjacent possible in the evolution of the biosphere, we don't know the sample space of the process. So let's take a fair coin. I top a fair coin 10,000 times, and I want to know the probability that it comes up, 51.4% heads. I can calculate it. I wheel up the binomial theorem and I do it. Notice you knew ahead of time all possible outcomes of flipping the coin 10,000 times. You knew the sample space of the process. Because you know the sample space of the process, you can define what you mean by random and you can have a probability measure. But you can't do that for the evolution of the biosphere because you don't know what's in the sample space. You can't say it. Therefore, we don't know what random means, and therefore there's no probability measure. It's not there. None. So we can't do statistics in any normal way. I mean, what's the probability stated in the year 3 billion years ago that Tyrannosaurus Rex would arrive? It's a meaningless statement. You don't know the sample space. That means we don't know the sample space for the becoming of biospheres anywhere in the universe, ours being the example. So let's go a bit further. We do not know the relevant variables, like hearts pumping blood. Thus, we can write no laws of motion for the evolving biosphere. Newton did. He said, position and momentum. I've got these neat laws, three laws of motion, universal gravitation, initial and boundary conditions. Here's how to do science. And it's brilliant. Now, integrate the equations and get the trajectories. Super. Can't do it for the biosphere. You do not know the relevant variables. You didn't know that hearts pumping blood were going to be relevant to the becoming of the biosphere, or that swim bladders were going to be relevant for worms coming to exist in swim bladders. So you cannot write, you don't know the relevant variables, so you can't write any laws of motion in DE form or partial DE form. We also can't prestate the boundary conditions, non-circular. So take the table with the billiard balls. There's the table. You can state it. The boundary conditions of an organism is the niche that it lives in. But the niche reaches out from the organism in all sorts of complicated ways where it makes a living. You can't say what that is. The organism in its world reveals after the fact what its world is. I mean, a simple example is you're making mops and you want to sell them. And you're making white mops and they don't sell. Then you make black mops and they don't sell. Then you make red mops and they don't sell. Then you make red, white, and blue socks and mops and they sell like mad. Now you have found your niche. You didn't know your niche before you succeeded. And it's the same thing's true in the evolution of life. That means we don't have any laws of motion, and we know the boundary conditions, so we can't integrate the laws that we don't have, and we couldn't state the boundary conditions anyway. Therefore, no laws whatsoever in the Newtonian sense until the becoming of the biosphere. Yeah?
Do you believe that, as my theory, we don't know the laws of motion for evolving biosphere? Would you say we will never know? So is this like a...
Yes, we won't
know yet?
No, I'm saying that we will never know. And the reason is you cannot pre-state all possible tasks.
So no matter how much scientific development...
Won't change it.
...in millennia.
How would you pre-state all possible... Why don't I just finish? But how would you pre-state all possible uses of screwdrivers for all possible tasks? You can't. Because just think of it. It's not in the category of physics. It's in the category of things to do. And the category of things to do is what makes a Kantian whole get to exist in the universe above the level where the universe is ergodic of 500 Daltons. So they're really your hearts. But you couldn't have said 3.7 billion years ago that hearts would come to exist, or feathers, or scales. You had no categories to say it. And the reason is, it's not mysterious, but it's deep. There's no listing of all possible tasks to be solved such that something can make a living in its world any more than there is in the economy. I mean, nobody knew 30,000 years ago that you could make a living programming computers, right? So, go on.
There's another question.
Yeah? Yeah.
So, can we go one step reconciling that?
Can we do what?
So it's like, if I cannot pre-state everything, that's true, but given any observable I might invented, I can always invent the definition of phase space and the...
Try it.
For example, the screwdriver, the use of screwdriver, if I define observable of the effect of heating on something...
The what?
Of us heat something, then I can model it as a vector in the 3D space. That's sufficient as... I can define a phase space for it sufficient for the observable of the effect of heat on something.
You think so? What about using it to spear a fish and selling the spear for 5% of the catch?
Hence, even though I cannot know all the function of observable, but as long as I invent one, I can always define the relevant phase space for it.
Let me finish and let's come back. And your struggle is the right one. And what you're saying is, yes, I can, okay? Of course I can. It's just this object in three space with so many atoms, right? And of course it is an object in three space with so many atoms. And okay, let's come, you're on the central point. Can you ever say, and so is Marina, can we ever say all possible uses of anything to accomplish any task in anything that's around now? By the way, there's another piece of this. The possible uses of a screwdriver in empty space are a lot fewer than the uses of screwdrivers in Waterloo. It's context dependent, right? Okay, so there's something else mysterious. The uses of things depend on the other things that you can use them with, which is the same thing as saying it's easier to jury-rig if you've got 100 things of junk in your garage than one, right? So that's the TAP equation. So let's come back to it because you're struggling with the right thing, and I may be a lot wrong. So since we don't have any laws and we can't say what the boundary conditions are, we can't integrate the laws we don't have. So claim is no laws at all until the evolution of this biosphere or any biospheres in the universe. None. You can't do Newton. We're beyond the Newtonian paradigm. So this is literally that for the first time in 350 years since Newton, we're literally forced beyond the Newtonian paradigm of laws of motion, initial and boundary conditions, then the entailed trajectories of things in pre-stated phase spaces. You can't do it. So it's the end of a physics worldview. It's not terrible, it's absolutely wonderful. Look at all this neat stuff. There's no laws that entail the becoming of the biosphere. Biosphere is doing just fine. It's been around for 3.7 billion years and it's made redwood trees. And in the United States, it's made Trump, maybe kill him pretty soon. And it's made, you know, sea urchins and all these neat things. So I want to say something else. This really says something like, what if there's 10 to the 22 planets out there, and there's biospheres all over the place, that are complicated like ours, and you cannot deduce what they're going to become. You can't, it's not entailed. Then it's magic. It's just as much magic as you can want. This means that these worlds depend upon physics. Of course they do, but it's beyond physics in the sense that there's no entailing laws, as Newton or Schrodinger. It may be the case that that biospheres are as vast in the universe as physics in some funny sense. And in fact, that's partly what Marina is talking about. How do we know that biospheres are just huge in the becoming of the universe? I think they probably are. And I'm also thinking that there may be a fourth law, Lee, that we've been talking about. And it is that the adjacent possible phase space of our universe tends to increase. It doesn't always increase. There's huge extinction events in the biological record. And in the economy, there's what's called Schumpeterian gales of creative destruction. And this comes back, Lee, to try to do this with Carlo and you, Marina. The space of possibilities of the universe is increasing as a secular trend. It obviously is. And that wouldn't be true in all possible universes. A universe that popped into existence and out of existence, it wouldn't be true. So I think there's something like a fourth law, if you want to call it that. And Lee, this is the idea that the phase space is expanding, so the entropy of what exists is going down because it's a smaller subspace of the space, but only in this universe. Then we have to ask why this universe, and that's a problem to be solved by Lee, you know, tomorrow. And I'm almost done. I guess I'm going to end with this. So Lee wants to look at precedence, which I think is lovely, but meanwhile, the fourth law is true. It's in this universe. So I'll end on the following things. Why are there the laws of the universe? Well, it's Newton's laws, and one answer is shut up. It's Newton's laws. There's no further question to be asked. Another answer to why these laws are, there's an awful lot of universes, and they kind of have a whole bunch of laws, and we lucked out. Here we are. So that's the weak anthropic principle. But another possibility that Lee likes, I must say I like, is that we're in one universe and the laws can evolve. You know, why not think of that? I mean, why have all of these multiple universes that we can never see? I'm now out of ways to do that. But let me summarize with my thank you. I think this, if I'm right, and it's not just me, Giuseppe Longo and Niall Montebello, we published the paper in 2012, the physics worldview, in the sense of entailing laws, really stops once you're in the non-ergodic universe above the level of 500 Daltons, and which gets to exist includes things that are alive, they're autocatalytic systems, and the functions of things are how they sustain the whole. So there are hearts sustaining you, and Gonon Ashkenazi's peptides, and they sustain themselves existing in the universe at a level of complexity where most things will never exist. That's why it's mysterious, their hearts. Why are there hearts? You're not going to derive it from physics. You got to get to life and let life evolve, and it's going to evolve in a way that's not describable by any entailing law. You can either be sad or you can just say how much magic you need, and that's what I think. Thanks. Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, if you consider a much simpler system.
What?
If you consider a much simpler system in comparison to all of life and evolution and everything, but just look at the way in which a biological system works at the level of the cell, over the last 20 years, using our understanding, well, not necessarily just the physics, but, you know, chemistry, which derives from physics, we understand active matter much more than we did 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's completely non-ergodic.
Yeah.
That has a self-driving, it's a non-linear system.
Mm-hmm.
We understand far more of it than we might have imagined 50 years ago. So the idea that we just haven't found the right, I mean, going back to this thing that we just haven't found the right variables to think about things. Maybe, you know, our vision is limited, and just like you say, we can't imagine what we will do, you know, 100 years from now, what kind of physics we'll do 1,000 years from now. We can't imagine it.
So that's okay.
We can't make a statement, so precisely because of what you're saying, we can't make a statement about the physics we'll discover 200 years from now that would actually tell us, because we know examples of systems where 50 years ago people would say, you can't use physics to describe any aspect of cellular
structure
and active matter. And now there are so many, not saying they found the definitive theory, but there's definitely huge progress in that direction. So
I knew that I would anger people. So look, yes, I mean, you're all physics.
I'm not angered at all.
Oh, good. No, I know. I know.
I mean, I'm just trying to make a point.
So look, if one says, do we know how physics is going to evolve in the future? Of course not. It will do all kinds of things.
They're all scientists.
Yes.
Not just physics.
Sure.
Right?
Well, there's
biology.
Yeah, there's biology and there's paleontology, which is an historical science. Paleontologists really study who came first and who came later and what happened to T-Rex and us. And that's science too. The question is, and that's fine science, it's historical science, and it's the history of what became in life. And then we have stories about entropy and increase in entropy and Schrodinger, all that stuff, like Carlo's paper and my paper. The question is, can you deduce the uses of things? And the screwdriver argument's central to it. Can you deduce all the uses of a screwdriver? If you can, I'm wrong. I don't think you can deduce all the uses of screwdrivers for all possible purposes.
We know one underlying principle, which is underlies all the uses of a screwdriver, which is the use that will, the getting to exist. Principle.
Yes, yes.
So
getting to exist is funny.
The use will be selected is the one that allows
it to get to exist.
To be used.
Yes, I agree. So I really like that a lot. We're saying the same thing.